You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Vox and Hop's Brutal North America is presented by Indie Merch Store.
And I'm sorry that I was in this band for so long, like doing all this shit, you know. Yeah, I don't know. It just didn't seem like a strange thing to me. And then now it's just like, you know, like Dead Cross is a great example. Like everybody's in a fucking million bands, and it just, you know, and the only thing I can hope for is that we all come back, you know, to do it again or whatever. So it just doesn't, I don't know. It is a strange thing. Part of me is kind of glad that I'm not known as the guy from the one band, but also it might have been easier that way, you know, like it seems like less shit to organize. Cause there are times where I'm like, fuck these email threads, or like, you know, or these schedules, or.
Hey, what's up, Vox and Hops heads? I'm Matt, the vocalist of Cryptopsy and the host of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, brought to you by Sound Talent Media, where I sit down with fellow metal musicians, talk about their lives, music, and craft beer. I hope you had a glorious weekend. I most certainly did, because Brutal North America is here. It's in full effect. It's in full swing. Vox and Hops Brutal North America is presented by Indie Merch Store, is fueled by Heartbeat Hot Sauce Company, and is powered by Yakima Chief Hops. Now, there have been 22 brand new Vox and Hops collaborative brews, which have been dropping throughout the past week. There are still a few that will be dropping throughout this week. I am just so damn proud and excited of all of the beautiful humans that have worked together and collaborated together to make Vox and Hops Brutal North America a reality. But there are a few key people that I must give massive shout-outs to. Now, I must give a huge thanks to Chris Kells of The Agonist for creating all of the mini-docs that you've been seeing on the Vox and Hops socials. I'd also like to give a huge shout-out to Mihala Petrescu of Miha on Tour for taking all the killer pictures. The artwork for Brutal North America has been created by Philip Ivanovic. You got Jeannie Bond that helped me with the label design, Philip Rousseau, who created all of the original music that you are hearing in these videos. Got Asher Media Relations, who has helped me spread the word about the project. And a massive shout out to Andrew Tremblay for designing the sick Brutal North America logo, as well as creating the flyer. If you'd like to find out some more information about Brutal North America, head on over to my website, voxandhops.com. That's voxandhops.com. And there's a whole bunch of extra information there. This Vox and Hops episode is presented by Heavy Montreal. Heavy Montreal is Montreal's premier metal promoter. They put on a bunch of sick shows throughout the year, but not only that, they also put on one of North America's best metal festivals, and that's the absolute truth. I have played festivals all around the globe, and Heavy Montreal is up there with the best of them. I am just so damn stoked to have Heavy Montreal behind the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. Now, before we jump into today's episode, I'd just like to ask you to follow the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast on the podcast platform of your choice. But more than that, I'm also asking you to rate it and write a review, because when you do that, more metalheads just like yourself will be able to discover the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. Now, why do I say this? I say this because when someone is looking for a new podcast to invest their time in, what do? They scroll down, they check out the reviews, and if those reviews are a bunch of positive reviews reflecting cool things that they enjoy, they will most probably give that podcast a chance. So if you were to write a review for the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, you could actually be the person that's sways someone into becoming a brand new Vox and Hops head, and that would be something that I would truly appreciate. Now, in today's episode, I'm with Justin Pearson of The Locust, Dead Cross, Planet Satan, and a whole bunch of other projects, but he also runs 31G Records. Get ready, everyone. This is Vox and Hops episode number 277.
I warn you, what you are about to hear is very disturbing indeed.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today I'm with JP, Justin Pearson of The Locust, Swing Kids. He runs 31G Records. He's also in Dead Cross. Justin, how are you doing?
I'm decent.
Let's start off with a mammoth of a question, something that I like to throw at people right at the beginning. How did you cope with the glorious year that is now behind us of 2020?
Okay, well, that's a loaded question. I mean, I don't know. Like, we're, you know, I mean, like, punks are bred for the apocalypse, you know? So it's just like, all right, cool. Like, the world's turning to shit. Like, we'll just figure out a way. And I mean, I kind of, looking back, I'm like, well, that wasn't as bad as I thought it should have been. You know, I mean, it was fucking terrible. Like, I lost like close friends. Like, I haven't toured or played or anything. You know, it's been shitty, but like, I guess it could have been worse. I mean, you know, we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. It's been interesting. It's been a weird time for sure.
It's very hard. Is this the longest span of time that you haven't performed live?
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, I started playing shows when I was 15. I don't think there has ever been a complete year where I didn't play a show. So yeah, it's weird.
it's as an artist myself, I completely understand. It's so difficult to not get that output, to not get that cathartic experience. So how did you manage throughout this year without that release?
I don't. That's a strange question for me. I mean, I see what you're saying. Like, it is cathartic and it is like a release. I don't know, man. I guess I find those things like in other aspects of life. I mean, for instance, like, you know, recording and stuff obviously isn't the same, but it's very rewarding and cathartic to be like, oh, we finished recording an album. So during the pandemic, I recorded, an entire album and also other stuff as well with different projects. But that, and then just like I live in San Diego, so a lot of time was spent like going to the beach with my dog and stuff. And that was really helpful. I found myself going like almost daily, which is not something I would have normally done, I don't think, you know? So, I don't know. It's weird. You know, it's definitely weird. There's talk of this like 3-1-G showcase thing happening in August. It's not nervous, but like there's anxiety around it. Like, whoa, like it'll be weird to just do it again. You know, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like,
are we still going to like it? Of course we are. But, you know, we have that moment.
No, I don't give a shit what anybody thinks. I don't, you know, I don't care what anybody thinks. I'm worried about myself. Like, it'll be weird to walk on stage and like do the thing again, you know, like, like too much time has passed, you know, or I don't know. I mean, we'll see. It'll be fine. I'm sure. I mean, that's the thing is like, there is that level of like, for me, like when I perform with a band, it's always like, there's always this bit of anxiety right before it happens. And then as soon as it starts, it's nothing. It's like, you transcend and you don't think rationally and things aren't computing normally, you know, so whatever, it'll be fine, I'm sure. So,
well, it sounds amazing, and I hope everything goes well, and I know everything will, as long as everyone behaves. Please, people.
Well, behave. I mean, I don't know what like COVID behave. Yeah, but like behave as far as like
exactly, yeah.
You know, going ape shit.
No, I wonder, that's what we need. That's what we feed off of. Fox and Hops is all about hanging out with my metal friends, talking about their lives, music, and craft beer. What beer do you have on your side, or what drink do you have on your side that we're going to share virtually today?
Sure. Okay. So I was trying really hard not to be a poser. I'm not much of a drinker. I'm not a drinker. I'm just not much of a drinker. So I went the hard kombucha route. And it's a local company also to San Diego. So I thought this is cool. It's good. So the thing is like one of these will get me pretty fucked up, and that's kind of why I don't drink. I'm like, I'm good. Like, I don't think I need to drink that, 'cause I won't be driving, you know, like after one, like, so, yeah. So this is the beverage that I chose.
Amazing. Crack that open. I'm going to talk about mine. I'm going to be drinking, it's an old fashioned, it's a massive stout that has been created to mimic an old fashioned. So it's a huge, huge stout that was brewed with dark grains, of course, to get the stout, and orange zest, and then aged in bourbon. So it's to mimic an old fashioned. 11.9% ABV from Beauregard Brasserie Distillery right here in Montreal. They make only dark beers, and I think that's super cool of them. Let's talk about your very first beer. Do you remember the first beer you drank, Justin?
Yeah, it's funny. I do, because I was driving somewhere with my parents, and I lived in Arizona when I was a child, and it was hot as fuck. And I remember I was super thirsty, and my parents only had beer in the car, and they gave me beer.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, it was like 78 maybe or something, 1978. Yeah, I don't know. Things are different, you know? So anyhow, I remember drinking the beer, and it was probably Coors or Miller. And it was, and I just remember thinking like fucking terrible shit. Like, you know, like I just give me, like, I wanted like soda, you know, or water, you know? And it was like, it was a weird thing. Cause I knew it wasn't for children. And I was like kind of tripping out that I was just drinking this beer. The car thing didn't faze me. It was just that it tasted horrible and I knew it was for adults. But whatever, I was thirsty. I don't know if it did the job, but I do remember that being my first time drinking beer.
That's insane. That's insane. Cheers to your very first car beer at a young age.
Yeah.
Ooh, you can smell that. It smells like an old-fashioned.
I would like to say that I'm a big fan of kombucha, and that your drink sounds really good. I would be interested in trying that. But the kombucha, first of all, can I just say June Shine, if you see this, hook it up with sponsorships. No, they're cool. I mean, they're local. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to be conscious about it and like get that, you know, and it's, I have had a few of these like, at venues and stuff when it's presented. I don't go out much. So anyhow, this is the jam. Yeah.
Amazing. Let's talk about you evolved. Do you remember getting into drinking in your teen years? Do you remember any crazy stories there? Was that a part of your teen culture, or were you completely punk in somewhere else?
Well, okay. That's another loaded question. So, I mean, I think growing up, both my parents were alcoholics, and it was kind of a weird thing to be around, and I will say that I'm grateful that I didn't take the straight edge route in my later years. I have a lot of opposition to straight edge culture. Not like Ian MacKaye straight edge, but like, just like fuckhead straight edge, you know, like, I don't know. You know, grew up with my parents being alcoholics. It was pretty brutal at times. And I didn't associate like alcoholism, or I didn't associate drinking with their antics. So, you know, growing up, getting into punk and stuff, I mean, I was just hanging out with like, shitty punks and crusties and stuff. And it never really like was a thing. I mean, I do remember myself, you know, around the age 13 or 14, just my mom would leave me at home alone, and I would just drink and get wasted and then pass out. And I'm like, this is strange, you know, and it's kind of just to do it, just to like experiment, I guess. And then as soon as I got a bigger perception of the world, I guess, started touring or going places and doing things, it didn't really become a thing. I didn't need to drink. So I just, and also too, I mean, I think with that being said, like with punk and hardcore and stuff, like drinking became, or I guess alcoholism became what was also like, you know, pretty, present in my community, you know? So I'd be like, oh, so-and-so is super fucked up. Like, I'm going to have to keep my shit together, you know, to make sure that they get home okay or whatever, just stuff like that. I think I'm too responsible maybe, or also maybe too practical. So it was, you know, and I was in bands with people that were, you know, that had substance abuse issues. And so I kind of just like wanted the band to function or wanted my friendships to function with these people. So I kind of chose the route to be, you know, I'm going to just kind of keep an eye on everything while everybody does their shit and still enjoy myself. So there was that. And then there was also the introduction to straight edge. And I thought it was, I saw a lot of hypocrisy in it. And I also thought it was very alienating and kind of elitist. And also I just associated it with just like male white culture. And I thought it was lame. So, you know, I hated straight edge right off the bat, you know. And oddly enough, people thought like my first band was straight edge, and we weren't, because if anybody knew what everybody was up to, you know, we were definitely not fucking straight edge. So there's that. But yeah, I don't know, man. It was a weird time. Anyhow, fast forward. I at some point, like maybe around, I guess the age of 30-ish or 30, yeah, around 30 or something, I got this job at this at this really cool bar or club in San Diego called Riches. It's a gay club, and it was like, it was pretty insane. And it was funny because they try to only hire people from the gay community. And I don't know how, I'm not gay. I don't know how I got hired. I do know how I got hired. And I'm going to fuck this whole interview up right now, because I was like joking, saying that we were supposed to keep Jerry Springer off the table, but they hired me, I think, because they found out that I was on Jerry Springer through a mutual friend that worked there. And then they were like, oh my God, he was on Jerry Springer. Let's hire that guy. and so I had this job at this gay club for, as a bar back for almost 8 years. And it was pretty insane. And, you know, I don't know, you can't like hang out there and not have someone, you know, not like force you to drink, but they're just like, here you go. Like, here's the shot of Jaeger. And you're like, oh fuck, this is gross, but all right, here we go. You know? And so it became a normal thing, you know, to drink, nightly when I worked there. But you know, I'd do the thing where like, yeah, cool, you know, and like not drink, you know, because I had to work still, you know. But so that there was that. You know, and then I mean, since I quit there, I don't know, it's just not really a big thing, you know.
Which is a good thing, because if you came from a household that had a lot of alcoholism, you must have an addictive personality somewhat. It sort of falls down the tree. So you must have just put your addiction onto something else, such as music.
Yeah, that or like, can addiction be associated with OCD? Because I definitely have that. I feel like that kind of shit drives me crazy, because I see it. I'm like, you know, but I only feel better when everything is like completely, you know, organized or whatever. So there's that, but I don't know, whatever. Yeah. Here's to that stuff.
Thank you for being so honest. I love it. Let's talk about the soundtrack of your youth. When you're growing up in your parents' or guardians' house, what music was playing when you were not in control of the music? What music did your parents or guardians listen to?
Man, I think radio, just like normal radio stuff, was their jam. And I'm pretty lucky that like once I was started, like I got into music pretty early. I mean, I remember obsessing over, you know, Michael Jackson Thriller or even like Billy Idol and Pat Benatar and stuff. But I remember when, let's see, I don't know what happened first, if it was Van Halen 1984 or Break In the movie came out, but those two things like kind of fucked up my life in a cool way. I was really into, I think when Van Halen 1984 came out, it was a big deal for me. And my parents were like, this is, you know, it was on the radio, you know, so like it was fine and cool or whatever. So it wasn't the shift from like, this music's acceptable to this music's not, because there definitely was a shift where like the shit I was listening to was not acceptable to my parents. But, you know, first of all, I think Van Halen 1984, A Hofford Teacher, the drums are awesome. And then all the synth stuff in it is, without me realizing it, I think put me on a path to this kind of stuff I would be part of. Because, and it's weird giving Van Halen, you know, Van Halen such a pedestal. I think David Lee Roth's awesome. And I think that might be an aspect too. But anyhow, there was a lot of synthesizer stuff, which I thought was weird, because especially when you watch like the Jump video, you see, you know, Eddie Van Halen playing guitar. He's not playing keys, which I thought, that's so weird to me. But I think that my attraction to it was all the synthesizer stuff. And then obviously, like at some point, maybe it happened before or after, but when Break In the movie came out, I was way into hip hop breakdancing and like there was a lot of rap music that had like on Tommy Boy Records and stuff that had this kind of like electronic side to it, like weird robot voices and shit. And of course a kid's gonna like it, you know. And so, and then also breakdancing, you kind of dance like a robot. So anyhow, I was psyched on that stuff. And so my mom liked breakdancing and was really, like kind of supportive of me being into that music and let me listen to it. And like, I remember she took me to see Break It in the movie theaters, and you know, I think she was kind of tripping out, because like in the theater when it came out, like motherfuckers were just breakdancing in the aisles. Oh, really? And shit. It was so weird. That's amazing. And I was like, oh, this is crazy, you know. Like, I mean, I kind of wanted to do it too, but I wasn't good. But my mom was psyched, and so she was kind of on board for what I was into. Yeah, and I remember being into Kiss when I was little, and then I realized at an early age that Kiss sucked musically.
No offense, it was all about the image in the show, right?
It totally was. I remember hearing that song Beth. Granted, it was a Peter Criss like solo song, but I remember hearing it, And I just remember being on this, I was on a trip with my parents, and it was in the car. And I just thought, like, God, this song sucks. And at the end, they're like, that was Kiss. And I was like, what the fuck? Why do I even like Kiss? This band is not that great, you know? And especially because there was, like, other cool shit happening at that same time. But, I mean, I don't know. My musical taste is all over the place. The first record I bought was, I always forget the name of it, but it was the triple LP by Stevie Wonder. And I was psyched on that. I mean, it must have been 5. I was into all kinds of stuff, you know? And my parents were cool about it. They were pretty cool about what I listened to until I got to punk, and then everything got fucked.
I was going to ask, what was that album that was just too much for them?
There wasn't really one. There was this, like, my mom was kind of I don't know if she was oblivious to it. I think she just, there was a cool transition for me, which is obviously probably for a lot of people was skateboarding and thrasher. Mm-hmm. So I was really into you know, skateboarding culture and stuff. And it was the Thrasher skate rock compilations that were being released that I started getting, but it wasn't until I bought, I think I bought Nevermind the Bollocks on cassette by the Sex Pistols. And I was super psyched on it. And I traded it with a friend of mine who had the first Suicidal Tendencies record. And we both were both like, oh, we kind of didn't want to give them back to each other, you know? And so, yes. So that was the thing, like, okay, I got to go get a bunch of shit now. Like, I have to go buy a bunch of records. And so then I started getting the skate rock compilations, but it really, really what set my dad off was he hated the fact that I was into skateboarding. He thought me and my friends were scumbags. And then it was coming home and having Cramps, Bad Music for Bad People, and The Misfits, Legacy of Brutality on cassette. He saw the two of them, and I think he read the song titles and just, like, lost his shit he was like, what the fuck is this? You know, broke my tapes. And I was like,
no way.
You know, whatever, dude, I was like, you're a dick, man. You're an alcoholic. You beat my mom up. Like, you cheat on her. Who cares about the song Angel Fuck? You know, or who cares about, you know, Goo Goo Muck or Garbage Man or whatever. I was just like, fuck you. And then it kind of just projected, you know, it just made me go full force. And he was like, and I had no idea, like, anything about Sid Vicious, but he was like, you're going to become a drug addict because you like the Sex Pistols. And I'm like, I don't want to do drugs. I just want to get a fucking mohawk and, like, you know, listen to annoying shit and skateboard, you know, and that was it. And so it was a strange thing having that, but I'm kind of glad that my dad was against it because I really feel like that was like, I'm going to fucking do this now, man. You know, that was what I needed. So, yeah, there was a few things that transitioned me there, I think, into the weird realm.
You need that motivation sometimes to the amount of artists I've spoken to and their parents were so against it are the ones that just dove so deep into it. It's a,
sure.
I think that's so interesting. Completely different on my side. My dad, when parents were super into it, anything that I brought home was never too much, letting me listen to everything in the car, you know? So it's very interesting to have the complete opposite of things. How about your first shows? Do you remember the first live music experience you went to go see?
Yeah. Okay. First live concert. I was 7 years old and I went and saw Chaka Khan, and it was pretty weird because this was still in the breakdancing phase, I think, because she had that hit song. I can't remember what it's called. Anyhow, turns out I only liked one of her songs at the time. I mean, I think she's great, a great artist, but I'm not that much into her. But she had the one song that was kind of like popular and like in the breakdance realm or whatever. So anyhow, my parents took me, and it was funny because we were the only white people in this fucking place. And I was 7. I didn't know, like, oh, we're the only white people. But my parents were like, what the fuck? We're the only white people, you know? And everyone was smoking weed. I was like, oh, it smells funny in here, you know, but I didn't know. I was naive and
7.
Didn't really care. But what I remember was everyone being super psyched. Like, everyone around me was like psyched that I was the one that I was there. Like, they kind of, I think people must have, I'm speculating and I'm assuming and I'm hoping that you know, everyone was like, oh, the little kid is the one that's, you know, and they were kind of like, it was cool. Like, if I walked away thinking like, that was an awesome experience. Even though I was like, this isn't really that great of music. I would have rather have seen a different concert, you know? But, and then, you know, so that was when I was 7. And then I think there was this huge gap of me not seeing anything. And then it was like when I was 12, that's when it all started. I saw the Cramps play. And, right before I moved to San Diego, I came out to San Diego and saw the Cramps, and that shit changed everything. That was like, that was the one that just changed my life completely. A lot of it I didn't really know at the time, but in retrospect, I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, that was, I ended up meeting them and stuff. And like, just, I remember watching them, and I already loved the music and stuff, but I remember like watching them and just tripping out on all of this shit that I didn't really fully comprehend yet, you know, like Lux's clothing options or lack of clothing options, I guess, you know, and like just shoving a microphone down his pants and also Poison Ivy. And at the time they had Candy Del Mar on bass, could they just both look so badass and kind of just menacing. And it was cool to kind of see these things. So I saw this sort of gender bending, I suppose, at an early age without being aware of it. I was observing. I remember just obsessing and just watching and thinking like, what the fuck is going on? And those kind of things affected me in a good way, I think, in a progressive way, especially now, like looking back, I'm like, God, I'm so glad I was into weird shit and not like, you know, fucking Madball or something. I don't know, whatever bands that like my friends were getting into at the time, you know? So it was a trip. But that was the one. No offense to Chaka Khan, but the Cramps was the one.
How about your very first time on stage?
First show was not on a stage. It was in someone's garage.
Often that happens. Yes.
Yeah. It was with Struggle, my first band. I was 15. It was in this place called Ramona, which is just like, it's just bad. I don't know. Like it was, so was that 90? It was like 1990, I guess. Maybe 89. No, it was 90. Anyhow, it was like, just, have you ever seen the movie Suburbia? With D.I. and the Vandals and TSOL and those bands, not the other stupid Suburbia, but the punk one. It was very much like that as far as the crowd goes. Like that, I don't know. I mean, that movie was very important to me as a child, but it doesn't hold up because, I mean, like the part where they're like, oh, the guy's son or the guy's stepdad's a cop. And he's like, oh, that's fuck. He's a cop. And like, and he's black. And he's like, oh, black cop, you know? And you're like, what the fuck, man? Like, this sucks, you know, like, and you know, then there was like homophobic shit in the movie. And so anyhow, like all that was there, you know, and I was like, ugh, like, I'm surprised we didn't get our asses beat. You know, like it was like, there was like these fucking shitheads there. That was it. It was just mainly shitheads and a few of our friends. It was bad. It was pretty bad. And I was really into that. I was super, like one of my all time favorite records is Wrong by No Means No. And I was like, you know, I was 15. I was like, I'm going to wear a mask like the guy from No Means No. So I had this stupid fucking mask on. I don't know, like the irony and where that took me in my musical career is pretty, pretty weird. But I should have just like kept it straight and been like, let's just fucking play like the metal shit we're doing. You know, I don't know. It was weird. It was a bummer for sure. Yeah. But we had to start somewhere, you know,
especially at 15,
and, you know, but it was like quick. Like I went from like that to like, right away. I mean, I went from that to playing a show in Tijuana at this International Workers' Day celebration where like I don't think anybody liked us, but people were psyched that we were there because we were there to talk about, you know, anti-imperialism and the US imperialism, and they were, and people were connecting with us on this political level, and I was like, this music thing is weird. You know? Like, first of all, it's like all these fucking racist shithead punks. And then it's all these like Mexican migrant workers. I'm like, well, I don't, where do we fit in? Like, what is the thing? You know, it was a strange, strange start for me, but it worked, I guess.
That's incredible. You started your own label 3-1-G in 94. So very quickly after you started performing, which is awesome and unique, and a lot of people don't do that.
Yeah.
And it comes back to that OCD being control and having everything in its order, I think, perhaps. So talk to me about starting a label, why you have a label.
Sure. I mean, that's, I do think maybe it is partially OCD, but partially was, and it's an interesting thing to look back on it, because there's times right now I'm like, dude, this sucks running a record label. And it, well, It sucks running a record label. Like, it's fucking bullshit right now to put out a record that I'm on and do publicity. I'm like, this is not that fun for me. Like, the amount of work just kind of sucks. But I was very lucky with my first band with Struggle to be able to release stuff on Ebullition. And that label was really cool and sort of set this really high standard as far as what I thought I should expect from a record label. Mm-hmm. And also too, I was really into Discord and also growing up around Gravity Records and Vinyl Communications, there was this aspect of quality and also artistic integrity and creativity. So between Ebullition and Gravity, I was like, this is how it has to be. And so I started kind of dealing with other labels who were just shitting things out or farting the fucking wrong artwork out or like changing your artwork or I don't know, it just sucked. And so I was like, this is a bummer. I think I can probably do this at least as bad as these other labels. So I might as well do that instead of me being like, fuck these people, they screwed up our record. I just be like, fuck myself, I screwed this record up. So I just figured out a way to start it. And a lot of it was like stealing, and like scamming Kinko's for like photocopies. And like, I don't know, I was a pretty bad kid. I did like crazy shit. I'd stole tons of postage from the USPS. Sorry, USPS. Just fucked up shit. But I made it work and I put out. Also, too, I was pretty lucky because the first two releases were Unbroken and Swing Kids. And both of those records sold pretty well, toured a bunch. And so it was like, it wasn't a problem. Where I think most people, I'm going to start a record label. I'm 19 or whatever age I was, you know, and like, and then you end up becoming 30 and you got fucking 500 records in your closet still, the same record, you know? Like for me, it was the complete opposite. I was like, I'm 19, I'm going to start a record label. I was like, boom, there they go. Like it's gone. And I was like, holy crap, this is wild. I've soon learned that things don't sell. And I think around number, I don't want to say the number actually, because if someone looks up what release that is, that band, they'll be like, that's a dick. But it happened, you know, and whatever, I learned stuff. But yeah, it was crazy. But I'm also too not a very good business person. So for me, where I'm like, oh, I really like the creative stuff. Like, let's do a square 7-inch. That sounds like a really cool idea. Not thinking that that's expensive as fuck. And you can't sell it for much more than a regular 7-inch. So you're probably going to lose money on every single copy that you sell. And like, sure enough, I did. So, and I just did it over and over and I didn't really learn until, I don't know, maybe like 2 years ago.
But you've been going through so many years, you know, from 94, you went through Napster to everything going digital. What were some of the hardest struggles going through those years until now? Now there's a resurgence where vinyl is appreciated once again, so record labels can make a bit more money. But those years were tough. So how did you get through those years?
Yeah, I mean, there was like this weird thing where all of a sudden vinyl didn't sell. And so then I was sitting on a bunch of expensive product. And then the CD thing kind of sucked because it seemed like CDs were the one that were cheaper to make. And then all of a sudden, like that stopped. And I was just like, God, get your shit together, you know, industry, whatever, whoever's doing these shifts, like get the shit together. So it was like, it was just constantly learning, constantly just giving shit away, you know, like to me, I looked at it like, I mean, the Napster thing was weird. I still don't even use Spotify. I mean, I prefer vinyl and that's how I prefer to, I don't know. I have a problem with an algorithm telling me that I'm going to like this other thing too. I'm I think if everybody was, maybe not, this might be, maybe this isn't for everybody, but for me, when I first heard, you know, Spotify or Pandora, I'd say like, oh, and someone's like, hey, you should plug your band in here and see what happens, you know, and like see what they suggest. Next band, I'm like, what the fuck? And the next one, I'm like, dude, this is bullshit. You know, and then I'm like getting pissed. And so then I just can't really accept it, you know, because also too, I'm thinking like, let me put in, you know, I don't know, whatever band that I am enjoying at the time and see what happens, see what it suggests. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's not, maybe I should discover it on my own. Also, I have a very eclectic taste. And I think that the obvious route is usually the most boring route, you know? And so I don't know, no offense to anybody in the that got lumped into the Locust route on, or the locust chunk of music in on Spotify. But I was just like, this shit sucks, you know? And like, then I started thinking like, does my band suck? I mean, maybe it does. it was a weird thing. But so yeah, like I got stuck with tons of CDs, and I think they're kind of an obsolete format. So I would do the craziest shit. Well, maybe it's not that crazy. To me, it was crazy. I always have to go to Los Angeles for recording or what, rehearsal and stuff. So it's a 3-hour drive. And a lot of times I'll go up there and have to come back late at night or whatever. And so I always carry CDs with me, and I would just leave them everywhere. So I would leave them at, you know, the gas station or, you know, like at fucking Whole Foods or whatever. Just leave shit inside the stores. And it's crazy because, I mean, often someone would message 31G or say something on social media and tag 31G like, oh, I was at Whole Foods and I found this fucking, you know, this locust, follow the flock, step and shit EP in the produce aisle. You know, and I'm like, that's so rad. Like, I'm so glad that worked. Not that it makes a difference in the world, but it's funny for a second. And I guess that's value for me. I'm like, that's cool, whatever. I lost a shitload of money, but at least someone tripped out for a second. Cause I would trip out, you know, like, could you imagine finding that, you know, like in a grocery store.
That's creating unique experiences for your fans. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess it goes back to like Dadaist or something, you know, like, I don't know. I just want to, the subversiveness of the world. I embrace that. So anyhow.
Hey, what's up, Vox and Hopsheads? I just want to take a little moment about Cryptopsy's upcoming tours. That's right, I'm talking about the Scream of Perseverance tour and our headliner dates that coincide with that tour called As Summer Burns. The Scream of Perseverance tour is kicking off at the end of May and runs all the way until the end of June. We are supporting the mighty Death to All. We are going all over the United States, and we are hitting some of Canada. So excited to be honoring the legendary music of Death alongside amazing musicians that performed on these albums. Even more stoked to be doing some headliner dates in some cities that I've actually never played in. If you are planning to come to any of these shows, you should definitely grab your tickets by going to voxandhops.com/summer, and you will be able to grab all of your tickets there. That's voxandhops.com/summer. Do it, people. Come hang out with me. Enjoy life, metal, and craft beer in your hometown. Come to a show. We're going to have a great time. Now, enough about all of that. Let's get back to the episode.
You have a killer roster. Some of my friends, of course, you have early Cattle Decapitation, Zealot RIP. How do you go about signing bands, finding bands? Are you hunting, or is it submissions? Is it a mix of both?
It's a little bit of everything, but for the most part, it gets a little overwhelming when someone's like, check out my band. We love your label. Release it. And for me, it's like, not a whole lot that I release sells very well. Obviously Cattle Decapitation and maybe a couple other bands, but for the most part, it's a lot of work with little financial reward. So, and often it's a lot of me spending my own personal money and then going into debt. So for me to, you know, sign a band, I need to know them. I need to have seen them and hung out with them and have a connection with them, because it feels, I don't know, like someone, we get a lot of submissions, and I'll say that it's flattering that people consider 31G, and I appreciate every single one, even the formulaic like ones where they're like, dear label, yeah. We're, you know, we've toured, like whatever, but the genuine ones are fucking rad. They're usually like, you know, the Blood Brothers changed my life or whatever the fuck they're saying, you know, and I'm like, this is cool. And I listen to everything, but it's pretty rare that someone would just mail me something and I'd be like, this is cool, let me release this. I have no idea who these fucking people are. And it just seems strange. Like a good example is, I remember at one point I was friends with the band Black Dice, and they had released a 7-inch on Gravity Records. And I remember them telling me that they've never met Matt Anderson. And I was like, that's so weird. Like, what? You guys have never met? And they're like, yeah. We have no idea. Like, and they weren't like really familiar with, you know, like Antioch Arrow or Heroin or anything. I was like, this is so strange to me that you guys did a record with someone that you guys don't know each other. Because for me, it was, I had the ability to tour a lot with Locust, and that was kind of this, That was really what it came down to, because the Locust toured with Jenny Piccolo. So then we did records with Jenny Piccolo, and the Locust, you know, or like the Crimson Curse played shows with the Festival of Dead Deer. And like, you know, we kind of, and, or the Locust had members in Cattle Decapitation, or the Locust had members in Holy Moler, or the Locust had members in fucking every other band. So then that was like the sort of way to kind of make a community or a family out of something. And it made sense to me to go like, all right, I'm going to spend all this time and money and not really care if there's a financial reward. Let's just do this thing and make something really cool together. And that was kind of the idea of it. And it is a labor of love. And it's, so I think, again, going back to the, like, I'm not very business savvy, you know, I just don't think about that kind of shit. I think like, you're my friend and your band is sick, or like, what you do is so awesome. Or like, I'm in this band with you guys and this is rad and no one wants to put our shit out. Let me just do it myself, you know? And so then that's what happened. So, and that's still happening, you know, even right now, it's still happening. So.
Was there always an intention to do that, to create a community around this? Or was it really just something for you to release your own material at first?
Well, at first it was, an issue with Swing Kids when we released our 7-inch on another label, and it was a bad experience. And so Eric Allen and I, the guitar player, who was also an Unbroken, he was like, you should start a record label and re-release this, our record. And then you should also release this Unbroken 7-inch that we recorded. You can just have it and start this record label. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And so those were my first two releases. And that I think in a sense started creating this community. Also, I was really obsessed with Discord, and I was kind of psyched on the fact that Discord only released DC bands. And for a while I was like, San Diego bands only. And then I was like, no. And I was like, California bands. That's going to go. We got to, because good, there was, I was, you know, I forgot the first like non-California release. I think it was maybe Asterisk or something, which is like a Swedish grindcore band. I'm like, all right, fuck it. Sweden. We'll just go from San Diego to Sweden. You know, and then it was Black Dice and, you know, Quintron and Orth Realm and whoever else, you know, and there was, it just opened up, and mainly through touring, you know, and it was like, yeah. Oh, I'm going to tour with these bands or these artists and just, you know, fall in love with them and think like we're family and we should, if, you know, and they were open to me releasing their stuff, which also felt like I felt a lot of gratitude in that sense. Like for me to release a Quintron record felt like I felt cool, you know, and I felt like special. And I thought, wow, this is great that I can align with these other people who I admire and respect and appreciate and who I think are relevant and important in the world of art. So that was kind of, I guess, the goal of the label, but it never was really thought out. Like this is my thought process and this is my agenda. It just happened. And then after a while I was like, oh fuck, this is what I've been thinking this whole time.
Yeah. Just leading, you know, running with your artistic heart. I love that. Vox and Hops is the same thing. It's very interesting. Yeah.
but you know, like that's the most honest thing I could have done, I suppose. I did, and again, I never did it for money. I've never thought like this band fucking kind of sucks, but they're gonna probably sell a shitload of records because I don't have that record yet. You know,
you've collaborated a lot. Your whole career basically is just a bunch of collaborations with so many artists, you know, from Travis, from Cattle, Mike Patton, with, you know, in Dead Cross, and it just nonstop, just all the time with Gabe Serbian, all the time in many projects. talk to me about collaborating and having this open spirit. I imagine it stems back to the same thing as the relationships, connections with people on tour, and then wanting to take that relationship a step further to create something together.
That's an interesting thing, because I do think about this a lot. Like, you know, not that I'm trying to position myself in the world of music with other people, but it is kind of nice to look at other people's, I guess we could say, careers. That sounds a little, I would like to find a more special word than career. But a good example would be like, I guess, okay, like, let's look at, oh, fuck, maybe that's not even a good example. I don't know. Well, for a long time, you know, it's like, how do I even go with this answer? Well, I guess going back to the start of the thing, like the start of the label was, I was already dealing with Eric's two bands, you know, and it didn't seem weird that he was in two bands. And him being in Unbroken helped Swing Kids. So it wasn't, there was never like a thing. Cause I do see people that are like, we're in this band. Like,
yes.
I'm known for this. And I guess, you know, kind of, I guess like a, what it really made made sense to me was I was in this band, Some Girls, and we were on tour with Converge. And I remember thinking, you know, looking at the guys in Converge, and they're kind of just known for being in Converge. Obviously they've done other things at this point, but I think at that juncture, you know, like Jake Bannon's a great example. He was the singer for Converge. And then that was kind of the thing. And then I would look at myself and be like, or look at Some Girls, you know, and I was like, I don't know, like I'm in the Locust and Some Girls and a bunch of other weird shit. And or like, look at, you know, again, with Some Girls, like look at like everyone in that band, like Wes, you know, he was in all these other, he was in American Nightmare too. And like, and you know, I think at that time only American Nightmare and Some Girls, but it was kind of like, he was like known for these other things. So I kind of thought like, it's weird. I'm known for all this other shit, like fucking Holy Moler, you know, it just seemed like strange to me. But then I thought like, oh yeah, that's kind of like what everybody just does. And it went back to kind of sort of like a San Diego thing to me, because I do remember, you know, like seeing everybody in the band Heroin who were also in End of the Line, and they were also in Antioch Arrow. And it was like, oh yeah, yeah. So I'm also in all these other things, and we just kind of do all this shit together. And I liked it, you know? And so especially with the Locust, it was really interesting at one point, you know, some of us are doing Holy Moler while the other person that wasn't in Holy Moler from Locust was doing Le Choc. And so we reconvene and kind of do Locust stuff again. And I don't know, I think we all grew from those experiences and we learned stuff from it that was beneficial to what we were doing together. And I never had seen it as like an issue. And over the years, I've played with artists that I think kind of felt like, I don't know, like not jealousy, like whatever the word is, that they're just like uncomfortable that like, oh, you're also going on tour with your other band. You're like, oh, yeah, I've been in this other band for 20 years or whatever, you know, like, you know, so it was, that's kind of a strange thing to kind of deal with, or, you know, like when press comes out and it's like the dude from the Locust, and I'm like, it's not the Locust, but I see why they're saying that in the press. And then the other band member would get fucking pissed at me. And I'm like, dude, it's not my fault. You know, like,
press,
and I'm sorry
press.
That I was, yeah, in this band for so long, like doing all this shit, you know? So yeah, I don't know. It just didn't seem like a strange thing to me. And then now it's just like, it's like, you know, like Dead Cross is a great example. Like everybody's in a fucking million bands, and yep. Just, you know, and the only thing the only thing I can hope for is that we all come back, you know, to do it again or whatever. So, it just doesn't, I don't know. It is a strange thing. Part of me is kind of glad that I'm not known as the guy from the one band, but also it might have been easier that way. You know, like it seems like less shit to organize. Cause there are times where I'm like, fuck these email threads are like,
oh yeah,
you know, touring schedules
yeah, can be difficult with Cryptopsy is a perfect example with Ollie in Cattle Decapitation, in Cryptopsy, in Acurion.
yeah, that's totally insane. I mean, I'm surprised. I mean, I see why Travis is fine with that, but like they're, you know, I talk to Travis a lot. Before the pandemic, it's just like, that band is a fucking machine, man. Mm-hmm. Like, when do you get time to do shit, you know?
You guys did do something cool, though. I want to talk about that. I don't know if it's come out. You did something with Lucien Greaves. Am I correct there with the dude that runs the Satanic Temple and from that movie? I feel like I saw a picture of you, Travis, and him doing something. Did that ever amount to anything?
Yeah, yeah. It came out a week ago, maybe.
No way. That's crazy. Look at the timing. I love this. So talk to me about that crazy project there. Another collaboration.
I mean, again, like, and everything kind of starts with just like this sort of smaller idea, you know? So there's this guy, one of my bandmates, Luke Henshaw, who we also have a podcast together. So Luke Henshaw and I are in this band Planet B, and we have a podcast called Cult and Culture. And we spoke with Lucien and we were like, let's have him on our podcast. So we went to the Satanic Temple and recorded a podcast with him, and it was rad and we hit it off. And it was, you know, it was a really cool, in my opinion, a really cool conversation. And so in Luke's studio, where we work out of a lot, there's this record, Satanic Mass. It's a Anton LaVey. It's just sitting on the wall in this record room. There's all this shit, but it looks really cool. And it's, you know, it's kind of cheesy and funny and like spooky or like kind of organy, you know, like whatever. It's, anyhow, I love the record and I like how it looks it was just on my mind. I was like, fuck, we should hit up Lucian and do a sort of modern version of that with the Satanic Temple, because I already knew this, but I learned it a lot after hanging out with Lucian, that the separation of the Satanic Temple from the Church of Satan is completely different. It's like two fucking worlds. And so I started learning about the Satanic Temple and their social activist programs and like the stuff they were doing for like their legal battles, I was like, oh, this is the jam, man. I'm like, I'm way into this shit. So then I was like, yeah, let's do this thing with Lucian, make it this cool kind of, you know, Satanic Mass, I suppose. But have it be more nuanced. And so we just dove into this strange project and it morphed into a thing. So, you know, Lucian, this is, I think, his first time as a vocalist and first band and stuff like that. So, you know, he kind of came here and we just kind of riffing in the studio, like just, I don't know, what are we doing? And putting things together. And then, you know, we were like, let's get Travis to come over and do some vocals. And then he sang on a couple songs and, you know, it took a while, but eventually it came together. It was such a strange project. And it's funny because it came out last week and it's been received well, I think. I don't know. I never know what to consider, but in the metal world, it has been like shit on. And I'm really? Like, yeah, but it's not a fucking metal record. There's a lot to unpack with that being said. Okay. It's not a metal record, but everyone's expected it to be metal because Dave Lombardo is in the band, but not necessarily playing drums. He only plays drums on a couple songs, and most of the other stuff is he's producing or playing, you know, electronic keys or adding, you know, these sort of soundscapes to these tracks. So it's, I don't know, I think that the metal community just likes the metal one way, and it's like metal, you know. But I mean, it's like, it's because to me, you know, it was funny. Okay, so I also run the record label. So yeah, so when I was trying to, you know, put the metadata into the digital aspect of like when it goes to, you know, for like Apple Music and stuff, Spotify, it's like, what genre do you pick? And I'm like, well, it's not metal. It's not really industrial. And I'm like, oh, it's religious. Cool, I'll put religious. But then the only like subgenre of religious is Christian. And I'm like, well, this is bullshit, man. And so then I just went with, like, what the fuck did I go with? Like new age. I don't know. I was like, well, it's all going to be fucked. But yeah, it's like not a metal record. And so I was like, fuck these people that are just being shitheads and like talking shit, you know, like, and I don't really care about the shit talking, but I really do. I don't, Dave's such a sweetheart and I love the guy. And I'm like, man, fuck you guys for talking shit just about Dave. Like, fuck you, you know? And I'll get really mad at the comments, but I'm like, but he also like, you know, he also would get shit for Dead Cross and stuff too. So I guess he's used to it.
I'm
but
sure.
Regardless,
he is.
I'm like, this is, we got the motherfucking head of the Satanic Temple in the band. You can't get any more evil or whatever, you know, I mean, granted, if you've seen Hail Satan, the film, you know that Lucian's nothing
evil whatsoever. I love this. I had no idea it had come out. That's amazing. What is the project called and what is the album called?
Satanic Planet.
Really?
That's it. Amazing. Just self-titled record. Yeah.
I'm going to go listen to it as soon as I finish because I really didn't know it came out. That's amazing.
Cool. Yeah. It's really not metal.
I had just seen that pic from Travis, I want to say over a year ago.
Yeah. Well, we finished the record. Then the pandemic happened. Mm. Well, we mainly finished it. And then the pandemic happened. And our idea was to have Dave or to ask Dave to play on one song. And he played on one and he was like, I love doing that. That was rad. He's like, well, since I'm not touring and I'm not doing anything, and we're in this pandemic now, it's like the start of it. He's like, send over another one. And then it was like another one and another one. And we're like, fuck, you're in the band. He's like, yeah. And then so, you know, that I think the pandemic kind of gave it more time. And then it was like, and then we were kind of questioning in pandemic, you know, life, like, do we release this now? Or like, what should we do? So there was that. And then there was also the aspect of like, there were a few labels that passed on it because they were not wanting to put out a religious record, which I thought was interesting. I mean, maybe they just thought it sucked, but their response was that they were not comfortable with it because it was religious. And I was like, huh. One of the labels I want to throw them under the bus, but I probably shouldn't. But I'll just say the label is named after like a satanic entity. Mm. And I was like, dude, you're the biggest fucking poser calling your label that and not putting out the satanic record. Like, fuck you, man. Not fuck you, like fuck you, but like fuck you. Joke's on you because you're a poser. It's all good. And I said that to the label as a joke. But I think a lot of people were just like, we don't understand this. It's not a real band.
How do we market this? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we almost signed to another label and they were like, we don't understand. Like, can Dave play drums on the whole record? And we're like, no, he's fucking playing on every song, but we're done. Like, the record's done. And they're like, well, we thought like maybe, you know, the Slayer fans were like, nah, we're done, dude. Like, we're going to go to another label. And then of course it's like, oh yeah, that's my label. Fuck. I guess I'm putting this out. Yeah, whatever.
It's horrible for artists to be pigeonholed and to have to be a certain person, and then you absolutely have not done that, and everything you've created allows people to be extremely creative and be outside of themselves. So that's kudos for that.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like, that's a good thing to point out, because I feel like where, like, I wish I could have had the you know, the sort of success that, say, like Dave has had through being in Slayer. I also see him struggle when he does things with, I saw it with Phantomas a lot, especially when the Locust toured Phantomas. I saw it firsthand, like live concerts, and then also in reviews and stuff, where just the people that expect his realm of music to just be, you know,
Slayer.
It's like, dude, just chill the fuck out. And like, that guy's got a crazy ability to play other kinds of music and like is into other stuff. So that was a bummer to kind of see. But then with me, it's like, I don't know that, you know, it's like, I see criticism. I get it. But like, my criticism's a little bit different. It's not like, why don't you fucking be weird like the Locust again? It's, you know, like, you can't really do that. You're just like, I usually get like, that guy's a fucking asshole and all of his stuff sucks. You know, I'm like, cool, dude, like go listen to Tool and go fuck yourself or whatever, you know? But, it's a weird thing. So I am grateful that like, I'm sort of like, I feel like a free being, you know, like I can do whatever the fuck I want. Like, I'm going to start a rap band. Like, no one's going to, you know, people will not like it, but like, I don't care. And I don't have to hear about it, you know, because no one will buy the record anyhow. So fuck you. Or fuck me, I guess.
At what point in your career did you stop caring about what people said?
Probably when I played that garage in Ramona when I was 15.
Yes. Full circle. I love it. Yeah. It's been a crazy year. What is the best part of this pandemic been for you? The silver lining.
Man, not to sound like too woo-woo or anything, but I think maybe the pause that it forced on us, it was a kind of an interesting thing to have to accept, you know. I think I needed that. I think the world needed it. And part of the pause has sort of diminished where I wish it was still there. So that was the silver lining. I mean, it was like, I remember when the first like sort of lockdown happened and people stopped driving and you could see the air quality, you know, change. Man, it was a trip. And so that was something that it kind of gave me hope and kind of made me think like, all right, I'm going to get my shit together. Like, you know, try to lessen my carbon footprint, like do these things that are, that are, I think, important. It kind of just put things in a different perspective, I suppose, if that makes sense. And it also gave me like, not empathy, but it gave me like the ability to look at a situation and pause and contemplate than just react. So that's like, cause I've seen, I mean, so not only do you have the pandemic in here in America, we had like the worst administration I think that this country's ever had. And like, you know, the insurrection and all this fucking polarization of shit. And like, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests started happening. So there was a lot of stuff to kind of internalize. And I think all of it, gave like tremendous perspective on how the world is and how I am in the world and where I fit into it and how I can navigate in a more meaningful and like conscious manner. Where, not that I wasn't doing that before, but I think it gave me the ability to sort of reevaluate where things were and look at it in a different way, and then proceed from there. And I guess that's the silver lining, because there's a lot of not silver linings in this shit, you know? And again, I mean, that's one of the things, like hardships, once you get through it, you become stronger and smarter, hopefully. And so I see that, and you become more resilient, but at the same time, I don't want to, you know, trivialize the hardships, but again, like we're focusing on the positive. So those are the things, like it really did help me like sort of reset and sort of reflect, and I don't know. We'll see if it sticks. I mean, we'll see if it sticks with me, but we'll see if it sticks with the world too, you know?
Let's hope so. One last question. It probably doesn't happen to you very often because you don't drink very often, but every once in a while it happens to everyone, especially when you enjoy a nice hard kombucha or two. What is your hangover cure?
It's a very interesting question. I've never been hungover.
Wow.
Yeah, it's weird. And I've been fucked up. I've been like fucked up. It's funny because, yeah, I've never been hungover. The one time I went to this bar with my roommates at the time, and I don't know why. And I remember going in, and my one roommate bought us drinks, and I had one drink. And the next thing I knew, I was at the front doorstep of my house barfing. Actually, I was at the corner on my street barfing, and then kind of got to my house. And I couldn't get in my house, and my roommate brought my pillow out, and I slept on the fucking front step of my house. And it was really, really bad. And they're like, "You were hungover," and I was like, "Dude, I had one drink. Like, someone fucking roofied me. Yeah. That's bullshit." And so over time, you know, over like however many years that's been, I'm like, I've never really been hungover. It's such a trip, and I think a lot of it has to do with like maybe I have high or like fast metabolism or something. Also, I do drink a lot of liquid, and so maybe I just pee it out. I don't know. But yeah, so no hangover cure, but I am told that emergency packets are really good to take when you're getting drunk. I guess because the electrolytes, which goes back to the drinking a lot of liquids, non-alcoholic liquids. So that might be the part of it too, because I just have emergency all the time, especially on tour or something. If like everybody's drinking at the bar after the show or something, it's like, well, I have emergency anyhow every day on tour. So I never really had to deal with that stuff.
That's something you learned to stay healthy, to avoid the germs. Is that an emergency?
Kind of. I mean, just to stay healthy. Just in general, it's vitamin C and electrolytes. And I mean, on tour, it's like you're living in this van with, you know, six people or five, you know, it's like a petri dish, you know, and like you're playing in like sometimes pretty gross venues, sometimes sleeping in pretty gross places.
Yep.
So you kind of have to like be on top of your shit, because once you get sick, tour
everyone
gets
else.
To be, well, also, yeah, tour's worse for you and everybody else. So the healthy thing kind of started because I'm allergic to cigarettes. And so I would always get sick on tour back when people would smoke. And so that was a big deal, because performing as a bassist or a singer, I'm using a lot of oxygen up above everybody else. So I'm like probably smoking a carton a night or something, and I'll get bronchitis and shit. So I right off the bat, I was like, I got to keep it together. Emergency. And so it's always the thing. Emergency was like the jam, you know? So, and luckily everybody, like most of the people I tour with, are always like, yeah, emergency, you know? And so everyone kind of keeps their shit together. So no hangovers yet, but
it's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. Justin, thank you so much for taking the time, hanging out
thank
with
you.
Me, talking about your life, music,
yeah.
and a little bit about craft beer. I really, really, really appreciated it. Huge fan of everything you're doing. Everyone, check out 3-1-G Records. Check out all of his projects. I can't name them all. He's too busy. But I love it. Justin, thank you so much. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
you all so, so much for listening right to the end. You know that I love and appreciate that. Man, this was a fantastic conversation. Just one of those chats that when we finished and we wrapped up this episode, I just felt so invigorated, so full of energy, just so full of life. Justin is such a creative human. Amazing to speak to, amazing to listen to. What a pleasure to have had the chance to connect with him. He is in so many fantastic projects. He collaborates with so many amazing musicians, and I am completely not surprised about that because he is just fucking awesome. Massive thanks to you, Justin, for taking the time to have a chat with me. I greatly, greatly appreciated that. If you enjoyed this Vox and Hops episode, you should sign up to the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast mailing list. You can do that on my website, voxandhops.com. That's voxandhops.com. And when you do that, you shall receive one email a week containing all of the details of everything that has happened throughout the past week in the world of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. So do me a favor, sign up to the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast mailing list, because I would hate for you to miss a single thing. The Vox and Hops Metal Podcast is brought to you by Sound Talent Media. I have two more episodes coming up this week, one on Thursday and another on Friday. But until then, remember to enjoy life, metal, and craft beer. Cheers, Vox and Hops heads.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.